this one, I can drag out.
At ominously regular intervals, we face a vast, unstoppable threat. A threat that ignores the prayers of nearly everyone on Earth. But thank God this Sunday, as humankind again stared into the abyss, we managed to survive the Super Bowl. At the same time, travelling at 76,000 miles an hour, asteroid 2002 AJ129 passed safely by the Earth, sadly condemning us to an eternity of Americans beating their chests and shouting, USA! USA! You're listening to The Rest Is Noise, a podcast on a mission to assign songs to every concept, person, people, place, or thing in the universe. This episode, asteroids. I'm your host, Martin Dickey. And joining me, cellist from indie rock band Madam, is Sarah Gill.
Hello.
We welcome back Man About Town, John Sheldon.
Hello.
Omphalosceptic literature peddler, Tony Tasich.
Hey.
And making his debut, host of Glasgow's Anno Domini radio show, and until a couple of days ago, expecting this episode to be about socks, Sam Diamond.
Hello there.
Sam, you've got an impressive collection of socks, so I've heard.
I do, but maybe I should hold that for when the socks episode actually comes along.
Do you know much about asteroids?
Absolutely nothing.
Great. Asteroid 2002 AJ129 is the size of Hyde Park and bypassed the Earth on Sunday just before the Super Bowl. It was coming as close as 4.2 million kilometres or 11 lunar distances away, so not actually that close. Yeah.
Nice one.
And this year's Super Bowl, or Super Bowl LII, that's the 52nd Super Bowl, actually sounds like an asteroid itself to some degree, was between the Philadelphia Eagles and the New England Patriots. Now, the last time the Eagles were in a Super Bowl was 2005, the year after Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction grabbed the headlines. Does anyone know who was chosen as a safe option to prevent a controversial repeat the following year?
Cliff Richard?
No.
You two?
No. Paul McCartney.
Of course it was.
The former Beatle, who once reportedly paid for three jets to dump dry ice into the sky above an open-air gig to prevent it raining, might have been our best choice for a Super Bowl threatened by asteroids. But who did perform on Sunday?
Timbersnake.
Timbersnake, yes. Yeah. Justin Timberlake. Timberlake. The man who shared a stage with Janet Jackson in 2005. Going by the lyrics to Justin Timberlake's latest single, Supplies, it sounds like he was prepared all along for some sort of asteroid apocalypse. Said in a really irritating nasally voice.
This is the problem, though, with it being Timberlake, because nobody was interested. Last year, I stayed up till 2 or 3 in the morning, because it was Lady Gaga, and she put on a proper show.
Right.
Wasn't interested this time around.
I heard it was quite a good show, though. He started in the crowd. He took a selfie with a kid in the crowd.
Pretty original doing a selfie, isn't it? Pretty newfangled.
Bud Light made an asteroid-themed advert, obviously.
What, for the Super Bowl?
For the Super Bowl, yeah.
No, I didn't see the Super Bowl.
No, it's just a load of scientists stood around a telescope, decided to get the beers in after they observe a huge asteroid coming towards Earth because they're going to die. No one see this?
Certainly wouldn't reach for a Bud Light.
Right, well, we'll move on then. We're going to start the episode with you, Sarah. What song have you chosen that best embodies asteroids?
I've chosen Ladies and Gentlemen, We Are Floating in Space by Stray That was Ladies and Gentlemen, We Are Floating in Space by Spiritualized from their 1997 album ladies and gentlemen, we are floating in space. And yeah, the title comes from a book called Sophie's World by Justine Gardner, which is kind of about philosophy, I think. But the most interesting thing I think about this song is the limited edition blister pack that it came in. Like, it was like a little paracetamol pack, and it caused a lot of geekery amongst me and my friends when everyone got it, about how neatly or not neatly people would open the blister pack in order to extract the CD.
My girlfriend at the time had that edition,
yeah,
and I remember being very envious of it. I actually, when I first saw it, I thought it was space food.
You know, yeah, it looks, because it's too big for a pill, isn't it? So, but apparently they also released it as a series of 12 mini CDs.
Yeah, like a little blister
pack of 6 CDs per pack. So it was like sort of paracetamol.
With
pack,
a track
like,
per CD.
With a track per CD. Wow.
And it tells you how you should take it.
Yeah, dosage. It's got a dosage on it and everything. Okay.
So 1997.
Yeah, I think I choose a lot of my tracks from 1997.
Height of Britpop.
Yeah, height of Britpop.
Definitely does have a smell of Britpop about it, I think.
Do you think?
Yeah, it does. It's certainly more ambitious, more experimental, but it's got a feel of Britpop to it when I listen to it, for sure.
Oh, it feels like Sing on Leisure. It has that kind of like rocking kind of beat. It's a bit relentless, but...
Yeah.
I was thinking more of that the song Tender by Blur, but I think that's just because of the gospel choir. Come on, come on, come on. Community gospel choir.
Definitely
still gospel in Britpop. That's definitely a connection.
Yeah, I guess so.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it was NME's album of the year in 1997.
Was it?
Beating OK Computer. And a little bit of soap opera around the recording of.
Oh, was it? Yeah, just because Jason Pierce is the main guy in Spiritualize, isn't he? And
yeah.
I think the keyboardist he was going out with just before, and then she snuck off and married Richard Ashcroft from The Verve.
She secretly married Richard Ashcroft, yeah.
Bittersweet.
Yeah.
Very sweet. Incidentally, that album came third in 1997. Yeah, Urban
Bloody
Hymns.
Hell.
Where is Be Here Now?
You'll have to let me know. So, the asteroid connection then, relatively straightforward. The first person, personal pronoun, in the title, We Are Floating Space, is apt because there are many, many asteroids in our solar system.
Yes.
And that is why she picked it.
That's why I picked it. I basically picked it because I found that there's nothing really to differentiate them at all apart aside from size from planets. So they're essentially just like us floating through space on our elliptical orbits, just mosey on and about. Mm. And this track is perfect because I love the way at the start there's just this sort of bored sounding woman just going,
ladies and gentlemen, we're floating in space.
And it's just like, yep, that's just a fact. We all are just floating in space. And the other thing I quite liked about it, because the different repeating melody, so it's got Jason Pierce's melody that he wrote, and then he uses the melody from Elvis Presley's I Can't Help Falling in Love as a sort of counterpoint. And the way the kind of melodies weave around each other, almost, it's quite floating, it's quite sort of elliptical. I don't know why it's elliptical.
Orbital,
exactly. There's something about the continuity of the movement that mirrors that kind of endlessness of our float in space, along with asteroids, planets, everyone's doing the same and drifting in time. And the other thing that made me think of it, because actually when I looked into sort of asteroids, I felt the same as whenever I do sort of think about space, I just get a bit freaked out and want to hide, and I find it a bit overwhelming. And faced with the kind of existential crisis that provokes, all you really want is a little bit of love to take the pain away, isn't it? Which so,
in much the same way that Elvis Presley's Can't Help Falling in Love is very, very, is a love song and is very gentle and takes the pain away.
Mm.
And in fact, I think when Spiritualized perform live and perform that song live, they do intersperse it with lyrics from that song and they go into that song.
That's what the gospel choir is singing, that song in the background.
Right.
The two melodies sort of weave around each other.
Well, because Greystand...
They circle around each other, much like a planet and its sun.
Well, yeah. Well, Greystand actually interjected.
That actually doesn't work like that, does it?
It does. It actually does, yeah.
They don't circle around each other, though, do they?
There's a barycenter, which is the centre of gravity between the two things.
Yes, okay.
It happens to be within the sun in this specific
case.
Well,
actually, some asteroids do... There are twin and triplet asteroids that circle around each other.
And some asteroids have their own moons.
And some asteroids have their own moons, yeah.
Or some asteroids have been drawn in by planets to become a planet's moons.
Well, that's what the asteroid belt is, isn't it? Between yes. Jupiter and Mars. Did any of you look into the asteroid belt? It's where most of the asteroids in the solar system reside. There's apparently up to 1 million, some of them 3 feet across, some of them many hundreds of kilometres wide, and the biggest being Ceres, I believe.
Well, Ceres is now considered a dwarf planet.
Is it now?
Yes. Oh. Which partly backs up my argument, really, because it was considered the largest asteroid, and now it's considered a dwarf planet. But there doesn't seem to be a particular definition of what point does something turn from an asteroid into a planet.
Wasn't Pluto downgraded from a planet to a dwarf planet?
Was it? Pluto.
It gets really weird at this point, because it becomes one of these things called trans-Neptunian objects that fit into the category of both dwarf planets and asteroids. So it's if you want to dork out on this, there is so far you could go, both literally and metaphorically.
Can we talk about socks?
Well, I think one of the distinguishing features of asteroids is that they are irregular. So they're just lumping rock in space. But once they get big enough, like Ceres, and once they've got a big enough gravitational pull in the middle of them, they do something called...
planetary accretion?
Accretion, yeah. They do something called accretion, which means they start to turn into a sphere, which is why the planets are spheres. Why is Earth a perfect sphere? Because of gravity. It's being accreted, which sounds disgusting.
That's exactly perfect.
But it's being turned into a sphere. And if you're not big enough, you haven't really got the clout to accrete. Well, that's a disgusting sentence.
Sounds like bad dating advice.
And so are all planets spherical? Is that the distinguishing factor, do you think?
Of a certain size, yeah. But it's our definition, isn't it? What's going on in space is sort of up to space, really, isn't it? We're trying
to make sense of it all, and we cannot.
I certainly can't.
No. It's hard to believe it when you can't see it. That's how I feel about it. It's that stuff is apparently up there, but...
Yeah, who knows? Mm-hmm. It's all lies.
So that's the asteroid belt. There are another cluster of asteroids in the solar system which have unusual features. The Trojan asteroids... Now, these aren't in the asteroid belt, but they follow the orbit of Jupiter. There's a cluster ahead of Jupiter in its orbit and behind. The ones ahead are the Greek asteroids, and the ones behind are the Trojan asteroids. It's not the only planet to have Trojan asteroids, though. Neptune has 17, Mars has 4, and guess who else has a Trojan asteroid?
Do we have one?
We've got our own. But this is where NASA can sometimes be accused of lacking imagination. Guess what we named the 300-metre-wide asteroid that precedes us in our orbit around the Sun?
Moon.
No. You're just going to confuse people, Tony. 2010 TK7.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's an asteroid called Doris, though.
What was it?
Yeah, it's on the Wikipedia list of exceptional asteroids.
Oh, what makes it exceptional other than its name?
I don't know.
Because you can name an asteroid if you discover it.
Can you?
Yeah, so long as it's within certain dimensions.
Why are we wasting our time here?
There's a galaxy called Kate Bush, actually.
Is there?
Yeah. The scientists who discovered it were Kate Bush fans and named it after Kate Bush.
You probably see that more than you do her.
Yeah, you probably do. Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. All right, thank you, Sarah.
It's all right.
Compelling argument. We're going to move on to contestant number two, John.
Yep.
John, what have you chosen?
This is Emily by Joanna Newsom.
Anyhow, I sat by your side, by the water. You taught me the names of the stars overhead that I wrote down in my ledger. Though all I knew of the road, universe, were those Pleiades loosed in December. I promised you I'd set them to verse so wide. Always remember that the meteorite is a source of the light, and the meteor's just what we see. And the meteoroid is a stone that's devoid of the fire that propelled it to thee.
So that was Emily, the first track from Joanna Newsom's 2006 album, Ys, Not Wise. Ys was a mythical French city which was built on the coast of Brittany and was later swallowed by the ocean, according to both legend and Wikipedia. Ys is a fantastic album produced by Newsom with strings from Van Dyke Parks, who collaborated with Brian Wilson on the Lost Beach Boys album Smile, the ambitious follow-up to Pet Sounds, shelved in 1966 and revisited by the pair in 2004. And for indie credibility, East was also recorded by the infamous Steve Albini, mixed by Jim O'Rourke, and also features guest vocals from Newsom's then-boyfriend, Bill Callahan, who formerly recorded under the name Smog. Joanna Newsom wrote this song for her sister Emily. This song is about their childhood and watching stars with their father. One verse is, "You taught me the names of the stars overhead that I wrote down in my ledger. I promise you I'd set them to verse so I'd always remember." So Emily grew up to be an astrophysicist, and Joanna became a singer-songwriter. The full song is 12 minutes long, so depending on which 30 seconds Martin chooses for the final cut of the podcast, that will dictate its relevance to the topic of asteroids. So the chorus is that the meteorite is the source of the light, and the meteor's just what we see, and the meteoroid is a stone that's devoid of the fire that propelled it to thee. So when asteroids collide into each other in space and break into fragments, these fragments are called meteoroids. And when a meteoroid, comet or asteroid, enters Earth's atmosphere, aerodynamic heating of that object produces a streak of light, both from the glowing object and the trail of glowing particles that it leaves in its wake. And that's what phenomenon we get of meteors or shooting stars. And there is actually lots of nerdy chat that Joanna Newsom got the order wrong in terms of the chorus.
I was going to jump in here, because far be it for me to leap on an opportunity to criticise Joanna Newsom, but it is quite a well-known fact now that she does confuse meteors and meteorites. Well, no, actually, she confuses meteorites and meteoroids.
Yeah.
There are some do-gooders out there, some Joanna Newsom do-gooders, probably some of them been on this show before, who claim that this is all part of the narrative, part of the fabric, isn't it?
You've got to make it rhyme.
I don't know if that's the case, but I think they're saying that she is recalling her time with her sister and her sister telling about these things, and this is Joanna Newsom's memory of it, and maybe it's her memory that's wrong rather than her just getting her facts wrong in the song. That's what they suggest. I think she's just wrong, full stop. And I think it diminishes your argument, Jim.
Has it been damaging to her, to Emily, the astrophysicist's career, if this is what she was telling her sister early on? Does that undermine her ability to be an astrophysicist?
I mean, that I don't know, but I could suggest that, you know, she probably learned from that mistake and the painful lesson from seeing her sister so brutally vilified in the press for making a mistake of this astrophysical dimension probably taught her that never to make the mistake again.
True.
Who would you say was the more talented sibling there?
Mm.
I mean, I know who I would say, obviously.
Yeah?
Well, Emily. And I don't even like asteroids.
I thought you said you didn't know what they were.
Same thing.
Well, Joanna, also an actor. She was in the Paul Thomas Anderson film, Inherent Vice.
Oh, was she? Yeah. Was she any good?
She was all right.
So they must have quite an encouraging father. Newsom mentions something called asterisms later on. Asterisms, not far off from asteroids. And these are patterns that stars sometimes make in the sky despite not being in the same galaxy. So only at certain times of the night. So she sings, "Squint skyward and listen, loving him," meaning their dad. "We move within his borders, just asterisms in the stars' set order." Maybe referencing their different career paths.
There's also another good reference, astronomical reference. There's a reference to Pleiades, which is a constellation known as the Seven Sisters and symbolises their sisterly relationship.
Yeah, that bit of the song makes me feel like she's actually showing off a little bit. She's like, "Oh, I don't know any of the constellations apart from Pleiades." Like, that's like a humble brag, isn't it, in song. Does anyone know that particular constellation?
I've heard of the Seven Sisters,
but I didn't know it was called Pleiades or anything.
What do we think then, you three? It's a 12-minute song, maybe 3% of the lyrics reference mildly asteroids.
I thought you were going to say maybe 9 or 10 minutes too long.
Oh, she's a beautifully put together song.
It is.
It is a beautiful song. I should say my issue with Joanna Newsom goes back to 2011 at the End of the Road Festival when...
I was was there.
You were there.
It was so cold.
I can't remember that. I was enjoying Joanna Newsom with another of your regular guests when I was told off for talking by another of your regular guests. So I've kind of been sulking about it ever since then.
Glad you're taking it out on the artist. That's the, that's definitely the right way to go.
It was either her or Nathan. So.
Good choice, John. We're going to move on to our third contestant. Tony, what have you chosen?
I've picked a song which I probably will struggle to pronounce. It's called Kesenwa Can You Be? And it's from Dreams Come True. So that was Kesenwa Can You Be, which means Final Battle on Friday. I have to admit that I was hiding behind the Japanese lyrics and they don't really relate, but the backstory of the song is pretty good. So Dreams Come True are a pretty legendary J-rock band. Lots of people kind of feel nostalgia for them the same way we feel for Britpop. And they composed a couple of albums, one of which sold a million, another one sold 3.5 million copies. They continue to sell in Japan, they're pretty big. And the albums were Love Goes On in 1989, which I'd hardly recommend checking out. And then this particular one really stood out to me, which is called The Swinging Star in 1992. As far as you can see, when you listen to the album, there's really brilliant connections to the influences they took from Western music at the time. So it kind of occasionally feels a bit like Duran Duran or, you know, very poppy. Shall I explain to you the connection? Are you guys ready for this?
I can't wait.
I don't know, I'm not sure. Yeah, do it.
Japan has a current asteroid mission. It's one of the currentest asteroid missions at the moment, called Hayabusa 2. Ooh. That launched in December 2014. And this little spacecraft is going to 162173 Ryugu, oh, which is a near-Earth asteroid, which we discovered in 1999.
Okay.
So after this was released, maybe it predicted this in some way. Right. It's meant to go and land on the asteroid in June this year, and it will arrive back in 2020 with samples.
No way.
Now, the Swinging Star is my little connection.
Yeah.
This asteroid is pretty interesting. It's a dark asteroid, which means it's carbonaceous, it has mostly carbon, on one side. On the other side, it's quite like Earth, yeah. It's basically silicon-based.
Oh, so it's an S-type, because there are three types.
S-type and C-type.
Well, actually, there's four types, there's a fourth rare type.
Okay, this is a combination, a C-type and an S-type asteroid.
Presumably that's very rare.
It is pretty rare, yeah, in its particular scientific interest, and it happens to be really close to us. It's actually, I think it's an Earth-following asteroid, but I'm not sure. It's something like the one we mentioned earlier, which is the one with the name that was so catchy.
2010 TK7.
2010
TK7. It's our Trojan asteroid, which actually you'd assume might be quite easy to land a spacecraft on, like the Japanese are doing, but actually it has a really bizarre tadpole-shaped sort of flick and spin, which means it's really hard to... We can get a spaceship out of our atmosphere and hang around for an orbit, but then it wouldn't be able to land on it because it's too mental.
What's it doing?
It's just going whoa like that, which I can't.
Spinning around really quickly or something. Like the Phobos mission had difficulties with that as well. Yeah,
it's doing like a big spin.
So I don't know if this one's swinging or spinning.
It must be easier to land on, presumably.
I didn't research that bit. What I did find out is that its name comes from Japanese mythology. Right. Ryugu is the undersea palace of the dragon god. In a legend, a fisherman was rewarded even with a visit to Ryugu and brought back a secret. So hopefully in 2020 we'll find out what the secret is. Furthermore, linking to legend and myth, the person who I want to just kind of spot here in this band is of particular interest to all of us here. And I don't know if anyone noted a kind of certain resemblance to music that we were all quite seriously influenced in the 1990s, early 90s.
I think I may know the answer to this. Is it the Sonic the Hedgehog music?
Absolutely it is.
Is
yes.
It?
So Masato Nakamura, who composed these two albums and was the bassist for Dreams Come True, also was asked by Sega, because of his popularity, to compose the music for Sonic's 1 and 2 in 91 and 92. So at the same time he was doing these amazing albums, which were selling like hotcakes in Japan, he also sold the music to loads and loads of kids all over the globe who, from now on, will always remember what follows. No? Casino Night Zone?
Casino Night Zone. Well, it's funny because I also found this connection as well from the bassist. And it's the track Sweet, Sweet, Sweet. got like the end theme of
Sonic 2.
Of Sonic 2.
And there's a reason for that.
Oh, there's a reason for that, because he just didn't give a shit. He just thought, oh, I'll just knock this out because we've already got the melody written.
I mean, it's better than that. Since the album came out before the game, what it was properly an Easter egg, because you go through the whole game, and obviously it's Sonic 2. You can't like pause and save like boring modern day computer games. Mm. You can't like sit down and go and do something else. You can't leave the console alone. You can pause it within like half an hour, it'll overheat and shut down. So you don't have the time, and you play through the whole game, and your reward is a wonderfully translated 8-bit version of a massive power ballad that ends the album. And so it's just the same.
Unbeknownst to the West, essentially.
Until now.
Until now! Right. Yes!
So yeah, that I thought was... I mean, I had no idea of this. This one I put the album on at pretty much random, was sitting there casually playing Flight Simulator for a little while, and then I was like, wait a minute, this tune, the opening 6 notes, such euphoria, such relief, such feelings of like... What? And I had to research it. And that's why. Because I remember completing Sonic 2 for the first time and hearing that music for the first time and then leaving that playing for about 2 hours, watching the credits rolling around while I lorded it over my sister.
This reminds me of when I completed Mario World on Game Boy, and the credits at the end are pretty... You do feel euphoric.
I've always thought the end credits to Street Fighter 2 Turbo are really similar to Don't Look Back Into the Sun.
Less fighting in Street Fighter 2 than it wasn't.
And definitely less drugs.
There's even, to take it a step further, when Sonic was translated for the Wii, Nintendo Wii, there was a level called Asteroid Coaster, where you battle against asteroids.
Is that the link? Is that the main link? Because I'm confused about Sonic.
It is now, yeah.
I must admit, I looked up Dreams Come True earlier and I saw Yoshida and Nakamura, and I just thought, these are the players I get into my fantasy football team when I've got no money left. And here they are selling 50 million albums in Japan.
Is your fantasy football team called Dreams Come True?
It is now.
All right, well, we're going to move on then to you, Sam. What did you choose for Asteroids?
I chose Atari Teenage Riot Death Star. Were Atari Teenage Riot. The song was Death Star, and I think we're all agreed that was almost unlistenable. For those who don't know, Atari Teenage Riot, a German group, formed in the 90s. German anarchists, a hardcore techno group, famed for their anti-fascist views. The song was from a 1997 compilation album, Burn, Berlin, Burn.
Was it in NME's top albums of the year?
It beat Be Here Now. Yeah, so anti-fascist views, anti-Nazis, very anti-establishment. They signed very early on in their career to Phonogram and used the money that they received as an advance to set up their own label. So I don't think actually Phonogram ever made any money out of them. So, I mean, perhaps not quite as right on as they would lead us to believe. Hmm. I had to look all this up, of course. I'd never heard of them. Well, I'd heard of them, but my only previous reference to them was in the Helen Love song, Does Your Heart Go Boom? Baby, I love you. Which is much more my scene.
Well, they were regulars at Reading and Leeds.
But I wasn't, so that was the problem.
Asteroids. We've got the track title, Death Star.
Death Star.
That looked a bit like an asteroid, but it was planet-sized, so I don't know if we're going to go down that route. Any other thoughts?
I just wondered if it was referencing the fact that an asteroid could cause the death of us. Apparently they need to be, I looked this up, your older disasteroid needs to be at least a quarter of a mile in width in order to cause our nuclear winter. And
oh, any smaller and it won't actually do it.
Well, just it'll kill a lot of people. Potentially.
I think the link is the Atari arcade game, Asteroids.
I think you might be on something, Sam.
You're right. See, I tried to fox you with Death Star there, because I'm sure, right, as any Star Wars fan will tell you, the Death Star is very epitome of a planet floating ominously through space. But John is absolutely right, because when I hear asteroids, I don't think of astronomy, and I don't think of planets, and I don't think of minerals and rock fused together. I do think of the 1979 arcade classic Asteroids.
It is a classic.
It is an absolute classic. Those beautiful vector graphics. Mm. And for those who don't know, you are in control of a spaceship, and you are trying to shoot the asteroids and flying saucers that appear on the screen. So there is actually a song about the game Asteroids, but I thought that'd be far too literal. It's Buckner and Garcia's 1982 song, The Plate of Space. Asteroids around me don't know where I'm wrong. I'm somewhere between the moon and the sun. I'm in command of three ships and there's more on the way. I'm a space cadet, I can really play. Hyperspace. Push on the button and I'm back in the race. Hyperspace. Which was a mode you could go into in the game if there were too many things fall on the screen, you could sort of thrust and you would shoot off, but you could like appear elsewhere on the screen.
I did love that about the original Asteroids, the way
that
you could push through and you go through the top of the screen, you appear at the bottom of the screen. It had such lovely weight to it, that ship, just a tiny little press of the button. I think it must be the first game where the length of press led the ship to move stronger or
was it a space
lighter.
Bar? Not on Atari, this is
brilliant.
No.
Someone had a brilliant. Nice.
So I could have easily gone for the song that was quite clearly about the game and also used samples from the game as its sound effects, but I chose this because I think there was a much greater story to be told here. The game displaced Space Invaders, which had come out the year before it as the most popular game of its time, sold over 70,000 arcade cabinets, and earned a software company, which we now know as Atari because John has spoiled the reveal, earned them $150 million, and arcade operators in the US an estimated $500 million in just in coin drop.
Right.
But there were flaws in the game.
Right.
And it led to an act that was commonly known as lurking, where a player would leave a solitary asteroid on the screen and therefore wouldn't move on to the next level. And that way, flying saucers kept coming on.
Right.
And if you shot those down, you would earn more points.
Right.
And you could essentially just carry on playing this for as long as possible. And in 1982, that reached its zenith when a 15-year-old called Scott Safran played a single game of Asteroids for the entire weekend, earning him a world record 41 million points. Now, there were some arcade owners at the time that were complaining about these marathon games, but they were failing to see the bigger picture here, that there were in fact Scott's friends and friends of his friends, and in fact youth all over the Western world, were fighting themselves to get a position on these arcade games to try and beat this score. So, as I say, they were fighting each other. I think you could almost refer to that as an Atari Teenage Riot.
It was so basic, wasn't it, Asteroids? It was all pretty much conceptual. And I think it gave rise to metaphors. I often think of the game when breaking down a problem in my adult life. You know, you break down the asteroid into smaller parts and they actually get faster and more menacing. And you have to shoot those and they break down. Again, if you try and solve a problem over the weekend that you think is going to be easy, trying to put a painting up on the wall and suddenly the string breaks. You've got three more problems to deal with. Yeah. Then you try
and they're all worse.
You
than
go
the
to
the
toolbox, your hammer's broken, you have an absolute nightmare. It's
suddenly
just like
a flying saucer comes out of the out of nowhere and just shoots you down.
It can always be a bonus though.
God, your life sounds terrible.
The other thing I was going to mention there was the Asteroids was programmed by Ed Logg for Atari, who said that he had an idea for a game where players would smash up smaller and smaller chunks of debris until they vanished altogether. And that got me thinking about Burn, Berlin, Burn again, and conjured up images of the Berlin Wall coming down, which, a little bit of added info, not necessarily about Asteroids, but I saw on Sunday that marked the day that the Berlin Wall had been down for as long as it had ever been up.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Which was 10,316 days.
Mm. Your man Scott couldn't really even...
He's still playing Asteroids. He's been playing the whole time.
I still kind of like my death connection But mainly because when I was researching the song, I had the misfortune to look through their back catalogue on Spotify, and I wrote down every song that mentions the word death or something to do with death in Atari Teenage Riot's back catalogue, and I'm going to read them out to you now because it's quite fun.
Go on.
Sick to death, too dead for me. Death of a president, cyberpunks are dead, into the death, Deutschland, brackets, has gotta die, close brackets, death machine. And then I also, not including death, but I like the song titles Fuck All and The Only Slight Glimmer of Hope. So all of these made me think it was kind of the world destruction.
Very much a teenage outlook on life, isn't it? Burn, Berlin, Burn, it was actually it was released on the Beastie Boys record label Grand Royal. And Mike Diamond, which is also my dad's name.
That's weird.
They share a birthday.
Even what? Weirder.
Have they been in the same room together?
That I cannot tell you. Wow. He was quoted on release as saying, "This is the most punk rock shit ever." And you know what? He was half right, I'd say. Because it is just shit.
Sounds like the kind of music I imagine asteroids listen to, I think. That kind of growling, rah, and that sort of the stuff you can imagine.
We're personifying asteroids now, are we?
Why not? Why not?
Oh, they're called Doris or something.
Doris the asteroid loves Atari Teenage Riot.
Excellent work, Sam. I'm going to give you each a moment now to think about who you want to vote for as the winner. Quite a heavy video game slant too. This episode. We're going to start with a contestant who went first. That's you, Sarah. Which song do you think you've heard today that best embodies asteroids?
Oh, it's a tough one. I did enjoy the Asteroids and Sonic the Hedgehog connections, but I mean, neither of them are any Chuck Yeg, are they? So I'm going to have to go with Joanna Newsom, the Joanna Newsom song. Because I thought it was just really, it's such a beautiful song, and I really like the imagery of her and her sister and her dad staring up at the stars and the asteroids, and it's very beautiful.
John?
I'm going to go for Sam's choice, which is Atari Teenage Riot, Death Star, and it's purely because, on a personal level, the first ever time I encountered asteroids was the computer game as a kid.
Have you encountered many actual asteroids?
Not yet. But here's hoping.
Yeah.
Tony.
You know what? I'm going to have to follow suit. I think that was a similar connection for me, because I did indeed, when I first heard the title of the show, I thought, you know what? I'm going to try and include a video game reference here at some point. I went in a wildly different streak, but I like the density of connections. It wins it for me.
Sam.
It's very hard, isn't it? I feel like Louis Walsh now on X Factor. With a heavy heart, I have to rule out Joanna Newsom just because of her Meteorites era. And I thought Tony made a great case, but I am going to go with Ladies and Gentlemen because of the Pill CD, which I just like. I mean, it has nothing to do with asteroids, but I think it really conjures that feeling of floating through space. And that's the word I kept coming back to. And I know it's in the title, but it's just, it feels like if I ever find myself in space, that's pretty much the song that we're playing in my head.
So there you have it. The song that best embodies asteroids is Death Star by Atari Teenage Riot. Well done, Sam.
Woo. Bloody geeks.
Hear all these songs and other asteroid themed tracks in the Spotify playlist you'll find at our website, therestisnoise.org. Next week's topic, and mostly just to annoy Sam, really, who probably can't be here. It sucks. just a word of victory from the winner.
It's all about beating Paul McAllister.
The rest is just noise. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.